Welcome to the Rugby Coach Weekly Roundup Rodeo.
Welcome to the Rugby Coach Weekly Roundup Rodeo. I'm your host, Phil Llewellyn. Thank you for joining us for Season 5, where we're discussing all things coaching. My guests are going to present their key learnings from a piece of content of their choosing, and we then discuss its application. Three fantastic guests join me this week, so I'll hand over to them to introduce themselves.
Hi, my name's Nick Davey. I am currently the Director of Hockey at Sedba School. Previous to that, I've been a full-time hockey coach for about the last 9 years, working really in kind of, I suppose, development and then up through into performance. I still do some work, so I'm a head coach at Performance Centre for England Hockey, and I'm one of their DICE coaches, working with the kind of under 17 cohort.
Hi, my name is Becky Middleton. I was an international hockey player for England and GB for 11 years. Since retiring, I've kind of moved into the world of coaching, primarily just kind of with kids, although I've recently moved into kind of some more adult coaching. So I coach Guildford men's first team. I also run a coach education business, which is kind of all around trying to make hockey more accessible to people, and also just trying to make the actual coaching experience kind of more effective and more enjoyable for coaches. And then with Surbiton Hockey Club, I also help to run the community outreach program and bringing hockey to more kids and more schools.
Hi there, my name's Helen Weston, and I'm based at a grassroots club, essentially, Lim up at Cheshire. And I came through the club that way, started off coaching little ones as a volunteer, and one thing leads to another, and come up through what is the England Hockey Great Britain pathway stuff. Just got really into it, basically, and have coached through the talent system there, and currently coaching with Nick sometimes. At Performance Centre. I'm also in charge of the junior stuff at LIM, and currently in real life I'm a teaching assistant specialising in Maths, English and PE at a local primary.
Fantastic. You are clearly all very, very busy people, so thank you for giving up your time. I'm really keen to get stuck into this, so just before we do, to anyone listening, just a reminder to check out the blurb on Rugby Coach Weekly for all the links to what is discussed and to other resources as well. Nick, we'll come to you first. What is it you're going to chat to us about?
Okay, cool. So I thought, you know, sometimes you kind of read books that really resonate with you individually. And I suppose, you know, it's a coaching podcast. So certainly in my kind of learning journey, you kind of go through various stages. And I've done sort of various things over the past few years, one of which I did a master's in sports coaching at UCLan. And actually it was in the first year that I did that, so nearly sort of 2 years ago, that one of the lecturers suggested a book. And we were talking about the kind of coach-athlete relationship and how a lot of the kind of real context of coaching is really important. So, you know, there are obviously coaches that really focus on the details, you know, the X's and O's, however you want to sort of call it, the technical stuff and the tactical stuff. But actually what really kind of makes the difference is the relationships you have with your players or your athletes. And the book that I want to talk about briefly is called, you may have seen it already, but it's called A Boy in the Water. And it's a memoir by Tom Gregory. And Tom Gregory, I think he still holds the record, actually, for the youngest boy to ever swim the English Channel. In 1988, he was 11. And this is the story of, he got a gold Blue Peter badge for it. And he couldn't swim when he was seven. And 4 years later, he broke the record for the fastest junior to swim across the channel, and he was the youngest. So it's actually really, it's a memoir of that 4 year journey, but actually it's a story of his relationship with his coach, which I'm holding the book up. You can see that's a photo of his coach. This chap called John Bullitt, who ran the Eltham Baths and Swimming Club. And it's an incredible book. And obviously, you know, it does feed a few kind of my own things. Tom Gregory is only a couple of years older than me, so a lot of the the reminiscing around kind of growing up in the 80s is very, very specific to me. You know, his experiences of going on rickety minibuses up to the Lake District and camping and, you know, all those things very much sort of reminded me of my childhood. But actually, it's the thread that runs through it is the trust, the honesty, the high expectations, if you like, that were between the coach and not just him, but all of the kids that obviously shared the experiences of this sort of cold water swimming. Now, I'm not a cold water swimmer, but you kind of read this book and you want to be, you know, and you want to share those things. So I actually, there was a little bit on it, which it's quite near the start. And it's just, he describes after he's known Bullitt for about a year and he's going on a trip to the Lake District, he actually does a little description. And so it's just a little paragraph. He said, I come to trust him. We both had, that's his sister, sorry. Even though I was still scared of him, he was like a strict teacher from school, feared initially, becoming progressively more likeable. I had begun to understand he was different from the other adults I knew, and certainly different from my parents, from Dad. A sense of mischief and nonconformism was ever present, even though things had to be done a certain way, from the trivial to making a cup of tea, to the critical life-saving drills in the water. I was used to my parents' attitudes, which were, by and large, quite relaxed on most issues. The importance of these things, the things John cared about, was rarely appreciated by dozy parents or idle teachers. John's world, I was discovering, was forged in experience and practical application rather than in textbooks. And that kind of like, I suppose that's like a little description of, you like, his initial feelings of an eight-year-old being in the presence of this guy. And I just found it like an unbelievably powerful read. And so much of it resonated, the kind of like, you know, that you are as a coach responsible for a lot more than just technique and even success. You know, it's actually that relationship and that somebody actually will then carry with them for the rest of their life. And we do sort of maybe hear in popular press around bad coach athlete relationships, and you know, whether it's gymnastics or whatever it might be, I'm sure it occurs in all sports. And this is just totally refreshing. And you know, I dare you to read it and not cry at the end of it, basically. You know, it's one of the best books I've ever read. You know, I think that in terms of learning, you know, massive for me, you know, just being honest and being kind of true, and I suppose probably, you know, enjoying it. I mean, we coach sport. I mean, it can't be that serious, can it? You know, it's pretty trivial. So you've got to make sure the kids that you're coaching, you know, leave that every session with, you know, some joy for it, and hopefully a bit of an inspiration to get better as well.
Nick, I wanted to say, so did you relate it to the little boy? Did you relate to the coach?
Yeah, I think I did. I did. I mean, he reminded me of teachers and people that were in my childhood. And possibly, you know, as a coach, you can kind of get lost in your own sort of self-importance sometimes. And when you read a book like this, you kind of realize actually that's kind of maybe the reasons that I should be coaching, you know. So I suppose it helps you reconnect with probably, you know, going back to that whole thing that, you know, walking, you know, hands up if you're ever a kid, you know, remembering what's important to those kids. And it's written in a way where you can kind of think everything I say, every interaction I have, it is a lasting memory for the kids that are in front of you, you know. So that was definitely something I sort of, I think probably it's that counterbalance, you're kind of seeing both sides of it in the book.
I love that, Nick. That's fantastic. Really random stat for you. Do you know that more people have climbed Everest than have swum the Channel?
I kind of feel like I might have known that, but I think it is an amazing stat, isn't it?
It's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, genuinely. But yeah, it's got nothing to do with this. So there we go. My question is, I think you touched on it there. So is there now an expectation and a better understanding maybe that coaching is about relationships? So how do coaches manage the expectation of that? If you're a coach and you're not having brilliant relationships, how do you deal with that kind of, oh, everyone's judging me, I'm meant to be having these really powerful relationships, and can you have them with everyone? It's a slightly different twist on it, but I wonder as that becomes more, people become more aware of that in coaching, is it a real pressure, and how do we then manage that expectation?
I mean, it's really hard. I think the word I was searching for a minute ago, which failed me, but it's come back to me now, is authenticity, isn't it? You know, and if you're not authentic with those relationships, so I mean, obviously I work with Becky and Helen in the summer, and I've worked with Helen quite a bit, and they're both really genuine people on the pitch. You know, when a kid's talking to them, they look them in the eye and they listen. You know, I've been on pitches, I'm sure we all have, where, you know, you're not necessarily sure if the coach is that interested in your opinion and is more interested in what they want to see, you know? So, you know, authenticity, again, it comes from, I suppose, respect, doesn't it? And those kind of things. Can you fake that? You know, I think as a coach, if you think it's important, you're probably going to be quite authentic and quite honest. People who aren't, probably, it's probably not on their radar. I don't know. Or maybe they do get it, but I don't. I mean, I suppose, yeah, it's hard. I mean, I wouldn't want to judge.
No judge. That's what we're here to do. 100%. We're here to make. Yeah. No. Go on, Bex. You're going to jump in.
Yeah. Well, the question I was going to kind of ask Nick is, obviously, you know, there's loads of things as coaches that we can take learning from other sports and from coaches who work in other sports. And I guess if you look at it kind of in very simplistic terms, swimming's a very kind of individual pursuit. Albeit you can do it as part of a team in something like a relay, but ultimately you're kind of out there doing your job on your own in that given moment of time. So I guess one of the things I'd be sort of interested is to understand how, or you know, whether there are sort of differences or difficulties in applying some of that stuff into a team sport. Obviously that's an environment that we kind of learn, work in. So yeah, the stuff that you learned from reading that book, how does it look to you when you've got, you know, 20 players in front of you rather than just that one person you're trying to kind of get through to and connect with?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I suppose in this specific case, they were kind of very much a team in training. So when they were swimming, if it was in Windermere, there might have been a few in the water, but then the others were responsible for helping in the safety boat. You know, so they were never on their own, like in the pool, I suppose it's kind of they're on the side, but they were kind of sharing the experiences, which is probably similar. But I also think probably the other thing is it's actually taking time, isn't it? You know, hockey, I suppose, traditionally, I'm really lucky that I get to see the kids I coach now a lot, so I can build relationships with them. When I've been in club situations where you might be seeing, you know, a kid for an hour and a half a week, those relationships are really tough to develop. Maybe something that this guy, John Bullitt, seemed to have done in the book is, he has high expectations, you know, and by being fair around those expectations, but expect, you know, setting the bar quite high, especially for young kids. Like, can you imagine sort of telling an 8-year-old, right, jump into Windermere, start swimming, you know, and trusting that they can do it, but making them feel safe in that environment. You can probably create a lot of the safety within the environment without having intimate knowledge of the individuals, you know, just by demonstrating. I mean, today, Helen, I mean, we tried really, we were doing an assessment, and for the morning, it was 14-year-olds, so under 15s. And the one thing that all of us as coaches spoke about, and we're really explicit, that we wanted to take away that feeling that they were just being judged and tested all day, and that we wanted to make it that they were free to fail, you know, that one of your favourite sayings, Becky, you know, around kind of, you know, good mistakes and good intentions. And I think we kind of, that was the main focus for the coaches today. We didn't know these kids, but we tried to make sure that the environment they were in was one where they felt pretty safe. And we set expectations, but they were fair, you know, and that's probably something I might not have done a few years ago. And potentially maybe, you know, this sort of book are the kind of things that's influenced me just to sort of take that into my philosophy when I go onto a pitch.
Yeah, I would say definitely, like, the sort of the more experienced you are or whatever, you realise that the surface level stuff is just the surface level stuff, and you can't actually break through to the technical or tactical or whatever without there being some form of relationship. And the question, I mean, I suppose, you know, if there's 15 kids in front of you and you maybe have a better connection with some than others, I think it goes back to what you were just saying there, Nick. If you are authentic, if you have high expectations, you may not get on, but like, here I am and this is what it is. And you know, there's clarity around that, so you can sort of succeed on your own terms.
I'm trying to remember if it was Mourinho or someone I read somewhere where he said like the people that he has most difficulty with are the people that he speaks to first in the morning, you know. So he makes an effort to go and speak to the people that he has difficulty connecting with first, and because he knows he's going to have interactions with the ones he gets on with and that he's like-minded. I don't think it was Mourinho, probably not. It was one of those kind of, you know, Premier League coaches. Could have been, you know, Guardiola, Klopp, I can't remember. But, like, that was quite powerful. And I've tried that. Yeah, I do try, like, because there are definitely people that you just, like, you know, I mean, well, there's a classic one. You know, there was one girl this morning who coached all last year. You know, I was there. I went up to her, tried to make a joke. Straight away, bang, nothing. It's literally, like, silent, stony face. You know, I was like, oh, wow. Another one of the coaches tried again, boom, nothing. And we're just like, okay, we've got to try harder here, you know, and that's it, you know. You've just got to keep going, haven't you? But sometimes it's difficult, you know. I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, you can't always just be your fault as well, like, you know. Sometimes if you just don't click, you don't click, do you? But,
yeah. I think that's really interesting. That Lee, I actually had a conversation with Dan Cottrell yesterday about this. There's a lot of talk about coaches meeting players where they are, but I do wonder, like, what's the responsibility of the player to meet the coach where they are? Like, is that a given? Is that why we've flipped it and said it's the coach, it's on the coach now, rather than the players always coming to us? But I also feel that that's kind of like a explicit knowledge thing, but I wonder about them coming to us on a personal level. Like, have they got to adapt to who we are as much as we've got to adapt to who they are?
I don't know. I think, obviously, I suppose there's like an age thing, isn't there? Probably the onus is on us to be more mature, bigger, to understand that maybe those kind of relationships a bit better. At the same time, yeah, you know, I mean, we all know kids, you know, that some kids just, you know, they actively, I mean, it's a bit different in an environment, I suppose. If you're in a selection environment and you want to get picked, you would imagine that you would at least go some way to make sure the coach kind of had a good opinion of you. If you're sort of actively sabotaging yourself by your own actions, you know, but some people don't have that self-awareness, do they? And young kids don't. So, you know, it can't be, I suppose, it can't form our entire judgment of them. I certainly would never base a selection decision on whether or not I got on with a player particularly well. And I know that can be the case. You know, if I found them really difficult, if I found them that they weren't coachable, i.e. I was giving them feedback and they weren't, you know, taking that in and then reproducing it in some way or making effort, that's different to having, you know, for them not laughing at my jokes. Do you know what I mean? Like, which is tough because some of them are pretty bad. But yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
I think one of the things around it as well is it's kind of their support network. So, you know, I've got a real, I mean, a couple of you have probably heard me say this before, but I've got a real sort of bugbear around, particularly for sort of, you know, you think of like your teenager, it's way too easy, I think, now for parents and, you know, their kind of, say that their direct support network to kind of take responsibility for, you know, having conversations, approaching the coach, talking about their, you know, whatever it is, commitment, their time management, their school, you know, their other sports. And it's definitely something that I actively do, is really encourage the players to, you know, take sort of responsibility and have some accountability around that. There's obviously some, you know, considerations that as coaches we need to have around safeguarding and doing things and with, you know, the right sort of process. But I think it's a really powerful thing when a player who might be 14 or 15 starts to sort of take ownership of those conversations for themselves. But sometimes they need to be nudged in that direction, and the parent may also need to be kind of nudged in that direction as well.
Like, do you think it's always been that way, or have you seen it get worse? I mean, it's a generational thing.
Yeah, I mean, my simplistic view on it is that I think it's a product of, you know, the world we live in that, you know, when I was growing up, we got sent, I don't know, a team list in the post, you know, by snail mail, showing my age. You know, or we sort of, we sat in a room and, you know, and they spoke to us. And if you wanted to speak to the coach, you had to do it, you know, on the phone. It wasn't sort of a cop-out text or, you know, mum or dad speaking to them at the side of the pitch sort of thing. So I think you know, for me personally, I definitely grew up, I wouldn't have wanted my mum or dad to have that conversation. I would have wanted to do it myself. And I think there's definitely an element of that's become more difficult for kids. I also think there's sort of the flip side of it, which is the, you know, the parent sort of feeling that they need to actively take on some of those roles, you know, and that might be done with the best of intentions, or it might be done, you know, from a slightly different angle. But as I say, I think the most important thing for us as coaches is creating an environment where we allow a player to, you know, to drive that as much as possible. Because I think is, you know, it's a huge thing. I think, you know, my view on the kind of selection thing, for example, is that you're never going to pick a player because, you know, they're organised or they're the first person to go and pick up the cones or whatever. But that can be a reason not to pick somebody, because if, you know, if they're not demonstrating good sort of team behaviours or sort of, you know, respect and just all those kind of things, then if you're picking between two people, then that stuff starts to become a huge factor for me anyway.
Go on, Nick, you go.
I was going to say, yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think, and also maybe something I do more now, I'm more willing to give that feedback and then see what happens. You know, I'm perfectly happy to tell somebody that I don't think that they might need to like become more of a team player, and they might need to start thinking about their teammates more, which isn't always easy for teenagers, you know, to start having that self-awareness. If they then choose to, you know, internalize that and decide, I'll tell you what, I don't agree with him, that's fine. And then I'll happily make a judgment based on their response to that feedback. I whereas maybe in the past I might have made the judgment, oh no, I just don't, you know, that they're not for my team, you know. So I definitely try and see myself more as some being able to help them on that journey, and to try and help them become better at it. If they then, you know, and that might not happen whilst I coach them, but at least I, you know, maybe in the future they might reflect on it and go, actually, and it might help them 2 or 3 years down the line. If I just like, you know, say, no, sorry, they're probably just going to resent that even more, especially if they think their perception of themselves is that they're a strong player, you know.
If you relate that back to, you know, your book as well, it's probably, you know, the stuff that resonates and sticks with you for, you know, years and years and decades and your whole life. You know, it's the big stuff, isn't it? It's not some kind of little sort of, I mean, seemingly insignificant thing. It's like the big behaviours which you can apply to other parts of your life, and, you know.
And it's that, yeah. And as I say, it's that trust and expectation kind of thing, isn't it? You know, there's a bit near the start of the book where he moves from the intermediate group to the senior group. He gets called into the office. Right, you're training on Sunday morning. Be here 9:30. Tell your parents to pay £5 at the front desk. That's all. See you later. No, nothing else. But that kind of relationship is actually like pretty powerful. It's basically saying, right, you know, it wasn't a choice. We'd like you to come here. Oh, if you fancy it, you know, that kind of, you know, which is maybe a little bit more 2021. Oh, I see how he gets on. It's right, we think you're good enough. You're in that group now. Turn up. And then, you know, and if he turns up, right, you know, then the expectation is you've got to swim with the rest, you know, or in our situation, you know, you've got to keep up in the run, you know. And basically by being in that group is the feedback that we think you're good enough to be there, sort of thing, you know. And maybe that's been lost a little bit, and I try and sort of bring that back, you know. I certainly brought it into my kind of my school persona a little bit. You know, I try and set high expectations for people. I expect them to be on time. I want them to clean up after themselves. And if they don't, I'll tell them, you know, not just be disappointed in them. Yeah.
Fantastic. I think we'll pause that one there. Already conscious of time, we could probably just keep going about that because there's loads of other questions I'd like to ask. But yeah, we will shift it on. Becky, we're coming to you. What is it you're going to chat to us about?
So I read The Long Win, which is by Kath Bishop, who I'm sure many people already know or have heard of, but it, just in case they haven't, she was Olympic medal winning rower and then subsequently went on to be a diplomat and is now a sort of business expert who goes in and helps businesses and organisations to sort of develop themselves in various ways. The sort of central question behind the book is around what winning really means. And to be honest, I've actually wanted to read this book for ages because this is a really big question for me. And I think it's something I'm kind of thinking about more and more. To be completely honest, it probably has largely just reinforced a lot of the stuff that I was thinking anyway. So I'm not sure if I've particularly challenged myself by reading it, but it's a really interesting kind of viewpoint, I think, and sort of looks at the world in a slightly different way. So just to sort of briefly summarise kind of what the book is about. First of all, she explores kind of what winning looks like and how it's measured in sort of the modern world, as it were. So whether that's sport, business, education, politics, just kind of looks at how it's seen, how it's measured, perspectives on it. Then goes on to sort of highlight some of the potential flaws in the kind of typical way that society views the idea of winning. And then finally, sort of offers up some ideas and some questions around the idea of long win thinking, which is sort of focused primarily on not just looking at things in a kind of binary way. So it's not kind of you win or you lose, it's actually the sort of how you get there and all the bits that add up to create a result, and actually which bits of that, you know, really are important to us. As I say, that the book sort of reinforced, I guess, quite a lot of things that that, you know, I think about anyway. And I definitely think that winning could be more about more than just, you know, a trophy, a medal, winning a game, whatever it is. You know, I think it can certainly look like, you know, giving everything you've got, exploring your kind of capabilities, collaboration, teamwork, supporting other people, coping with pressure, all those kind of things. As a player, I was pretty fortunate in that I have been part of a number of teams who've won things and been successful over a period of time. But the more I've thought about it, the more I actually do kind of think that winning something might feel great in that moment. You know, if you win at a really high level, it might open a few doors for you. But actually, that's not going to be ultimately the best way to sort of define yourself, whether you've had a successful career, whether you've reached your potential, whether you've kind of been the best version of yourself. I think you can kind of you know, you can come up with plenty of examples probably from within and outside the sporting world. So, you know, two real kind of easy ones for me to think about would be like Marcus Rashford, Naomi Osaka, you know, clearly very successful athletes in their own right on the field, but actually a lot of the things that they're doing away from sport or related to their sport but off the court or off the pitch are arguably, you know, more important and will go on to define them and their legacy significantly more. And I do think that, you know, some of these things which are obviously becoming more sort of into the in the forefront of our kind of consciousness, i.e. things like well-being and health and, you know, having a bit of an eye on the greater good, as it were, actually they're not necessarily just more important than results, but actually they go quite a long way to deciding what the results are in the end. In terms of why the book for me is quite meaningful and certainly something which I'm constantly sort of grappling with in my coaching, I think we've been socialized to sort of see success, as I said earlier, in a kind of very binary way. So, you know, short-term metrics seem to be a real key sort of thing in our lives. So whether that's standardized testing at school, whether it's, you know, the way our political system works, whether it's businesses being measured on, you know, quarterly cycles, in sports context, it's, you know, it's a result, it's a league win, it's a, you know, promotion, it's always the eye on the kind of the next big prize. She uses the example in the book of Monopoly, and how actually for a lot of people that's kind of their earliest memory of a kind of win or lose situation. And that actually it sort of, you know, it almost forces us into perceiving winning as actually succeeding at the expense of other people. So, you know, she describes this Monopoly game you have when you're a kid where, you know, one sibling sort of has hotels and everything and then the other one throws the Monopoly board off the table. And I think that actually goes quite a long way to sort of illustrate, you know, what actually happens in the real world. The big one for me in coaching, we're sort of really encouraged to keep score in coaching. It matters to the players, therefore it should matter to us, is the sort of concept. And it's something which it's a huge challenge for me as a coach, partly from the kind of logistical viewpoint, but also because as a player, whether, you know, there's points scored on a Thursday night at 9 o'clock in training has little to no kind of conscious impact on how hard I try or, you know, my sort of attitude to training. But the more I coach, the more I kind of realise that that isn't the case for every player, and actually their motivation and sometimes even their learning obviously is tied into that. One of the things in the book is around kind of learning deeply means learning slowly. So that sort of reinforced, I guess, my idea that, you know, me getting in the car after coaching a session and not really caring whether the yellow team won or the red team won, that that's okay. That's sort of all right for me to be like that. But it's the kind of, how does that sit with my players? You know, do I actually have the right, do I have the time to challenge their way of thinking, or should I sort of just go along with it and, you know, create a session which they're all going to walk off feeling motivated by, but actually, have they learned enough? Have they learned well enough? Have they learned things that are going to take into the next session, the next month, the next year, 10 years time? In sort of macro terms, I think when the wider world is set up around these kind of binary win-lose, success-fail type metrics, it's sort of difficult to challenge the status quo. And I think for me, I kind of, there's a part of me that just thinks, oh, like, am I being stupid to sort of, you know, worry about this? Should I just, as I say, you know, have a winner and a loser in training and, you know, have some bonus points for something that we're trying to work on and be happy with that? Actually, I've started to think about it a little bit like climate change. So it's sort of that thing of like, you know, if I don't turn the tap off when I brush my teeth, it's probably not going to be the difference between the world, you know, getting worse in terms of climate. But that's not really a reason not to do it. And then in the kind of micro terms, you know, I coach a bunch of guys who want to win games, they want to top the league, they want to get promoted. I coach kids who want to reach the next level, want to get picked for England one day, and probably their parents have the same sort of aspirations for them. And I, as a result of that, kind of want those things too. But I think for me, more and more, the way you develop, the way you perform, the way you compete, and the kind of people behind it all are a really big an important part of actually how we get to those outcomes, or how we try to get to them. I'm getting there, guys, don't worry. So I think in terms of, for me as a coach, I definitely try to bring a lot of this stuff to life, I think, in the way that I coach. So I've sort of got my coaching philosophy, and I think actually having thought about that and how it relates to the book, I think there's quite a lot of crossover. But I guess the biggest sort of ongoing challenge for me is figuring out where it sort of sits in the world I operate in. You know, so how far should I push against the sort of, as I say, the status quo? When should I push against it? Like, just because I'm okay with sacrificing some maybe short-term gains, you know, for long-term developments, are my players okay with that? Are the parents okay with that? Basically, how brave am I prepared to be in sort of trying to make a change? But yeah, it was definitely a really kind of interesting read, and I love the kind of way that she talks about things outside of the sports field, but actually there is so much kind of crossover into different worlds, and it's really interesting just to, yeah, just to consider whether whether the world that we're living in is sort of the best way to operate, and how we can make our own little change to that.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I genuinely think you've just covered some really real challenges we face as coaches all the time. Do you know, on a daily basis, in that planning and in the environments in which we operate, how do we manage, I guess, our own and everyone else's expectations? So if you've got an answer, that'd be great, because that would solve a lot of problems for a lot of people. But I'm genuinely wondering if it's, and it sounds like a sit on the fence, get out of jail, is it just about balance in terms of, if people are motivated, as you say, to win in training and to do well there, do we maximize that opportunity? But also in the same breath, we find other ways to challenge and develop the others that aren't motivated by that short-termness. And then is that encapsulated within the environment, with the expectations we set, and with the kind of the philosophy in which you operate?
Phil, I would say, like, context is everything, isn't it? I mean, like, performance environment, is it like a development environment? But I like the distinction I've seen drawn before now between winning, which is, I mean, I think as we talked about when we were at Sedbergh, but it's such a blunt tool. You know, you've got like three options. Is that going to tell you, you know, how well you did, really? And that, so there's winning and then there's competing. And I think the more, if you can get that competition bit right, I mean, one of the last things that I did was like a local game, and you never, I mean, it's sometimes junior hockey is like the Wild West, like you just do not know. It's like, yeah, it's our B team. And then like, yeah, it's our C team. And it was like 7-0 at half time. And I was just covering, but I just thought, I wish I'd just gone over it and just gone, if it goes over like three games, I think rugby do it, don't they? I think the FA doing it. If it goes above a certain score at half time or a period of play, we're going to change the teams. But what Becky was speaking to, that takes me having a conversation with parents. Can you imagine a parent like piling off to Preston or wherever for an hour and a half, and then I rock up going, we're going to mix it all up, you know, are my team's getting beat? Let's mix it all up and make it fair. But what is the long win in this context? Does it really matter what a 9-year-old score is? Or do we want them in a game? I think Nick Levitt for the FA did a load of research. And there's, Nick, I think there's the Amanda Visek stuff. Kids don't care that much about winning. I think in the moment that they do, well, that's completely different to, you know, to your senior squads. But I wonder if, I mean, I like that distinction. I don't mind getting beaten, like personally, if I'm competing.
I think for my dissertation, for my master's, I did it on motivation, and I learned loads just from doing the research, really. And as Becky says, that the popular perception of motivation as well as winning is that it's either extrinsic, which is bad, and it's intrinsic, which is good, and that there's nothing in between. But the research really suggests that that isn't the case, that you can have extrinsic motivation, but there's a bit of a pathway, and there's other forms of, so this is something called introjection, which is kind of motivation that comes from an external source, but is kind of identified as being relatively kind of positive in a sense. You know, there's identified motivation. That's, again, it's external, but it's things that, you know, could be like parental pressure or something like that. So it's perceived by the player to be really, really important, and it means something to them. You know, it's not a bad pressure if it means something to somebody. But these things over time, if created well, can actually turn into more kind of intrinsically motivated areas. And I think what Becky's talking about is trying to, you know, from a coaching philosophy point of view, is maybe to get players on this pathway where you're saying, okay, yeah, I understand that you're motivated by that, but there are other motivations that are also going on at once. And the bit of research I did was sort of like, you know, a bit of a spider diagram kind of memory mapping exercise that the players did. And winning was in there and being competitive was in there. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the frequency that those answers came up compared to other things, it wasn't as big as you would imagine. But the perception is that that's really important. And the external perception from people not actually playing the game is that that's more important than the people playing. And people live up to those expectations. You know, they will say that winning is important mainly because probably they think that their dad thinks it's important, you know. Or maybe what Becky, again, I haven't read the book, but it sounds brilliant, is the coach thinks winning is important, you know. I think the scoreline is really interesting because I've done loads of sessions, you know, like when it's attack on defence for an hour and a half and the defence get really, really bored with not having the opportunity to score a goal. You know, what's winning for them on that training session on that night? And that's maybe where scoring systems and other stuff can be really useful. But I also agree that I struggle sometimes just to make everything a points value, because I think it then loses that meaning and it goes out of motivation just into distraction.
That's interesting. I do wonder about that. So I'll often play games and go, right, yeah, you know, reward the behaviours I want to see. Here's some points. And then the group is just like, oh, what's the score? Yeah, really don't care. Can we just play? And I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Yeah, crack on. And that was like senior men. And actually, they just really couldn't give a stuff about what the little mini score is. They just, and they didn't even count the main tries. So it's not like they're actually just kind of going, no, I ignore that stuff because I want to win at this. It's just I want to run around and hit people and do some stuff. But Becky, I'm really interested in terms of the elite environments you've been in, how explicit was winning, you know, in terms of actual result-based outcomes ahead of processes to get you there? because I always have this question around, like, does it need to be explicit? Like, everyone knows we want to get on the pitch and win. Like, no one's walking on a field going, oh, well, I'm pretty happy if we lose today. So, like, how much of a big deal was it? Or actually, is it more about then just kind of understanding your processes because the outcome will effectively take care of itself?
I think I'd say in hockey, or sort of at international level, I think, you know, the sort of idea of the, well, there's a process, you know, leads to the outcome sort of thing. I don't think that's a new thing. I think that's been there for, you know, a long time, as I'm sure it has in, you know, probably not all, but most kind of elite international sport. I actually find it really interesting because I think it's really easy to sort of go down the route of saying, oh, you know, well, we won't do competition and scoring for under 14s, but we'll do it when they turn 15, or they'll, you know, when we're an adult or whatever. And I actually think, like, the reality is a lot of this stuff applies across the board. And ultimately, if you're, you know, an Olympian, or if you're an under 10, your reasons for being on the field might be a little bit different. They might actually and arguably should be exactly the same, which is because you love doing it. And I think it's really hard to put your finger on, because I think there is a lot of individual kind of variation within this. So I would certainly be somebody who, you know, whenever I turned up to training, you know, I would approach it, and I think I'm sure there's a bit of difference day to day, and, you know, depending on what the exercise was or whatever it was, but I think I would approach things in a pretty consistent way. I would argue that it goes beyond the results thing again. So for somebody who's looking to maximize their potential, which ultimately is going to give them the best chance of getting selected, of playing well, of winning something, that sort of, I guess it's kind of recognizing what your drive is, and understanding that at different times the training environment may or may not kind of push you in that direction. So one day that might be just, you know, sort of jumpers for goalpost stuff. Another day it might be a coach standing there with a whiteboard and a clicker and a, you know, sort of tally chart or whatever. But I would still say that ultimately the people who are going to get the best out of themselves are the ones who train consistently, play consistently, not just kind of expect to sort of turn up and, you know, turn it on when it counts kind of thing.
Becky, do you think that's where, going back to Phil's point about giving points for behaviours, when behaviours aid results, players do them, yeah? They almost do them anyway. So the behaviour has to aid the performance, you know, and then I suppose that's the skill of the coach to sort of, like, you know, to find those things. But also, as you say, it's the player being bright enough to recognise that those behaviours are helping their performance, you know, and that's sometimes the challenge, isn't it? That people want a shortcut nowadays from here to there without going through that. And some behaviours take a long time to get good at. I mean, I can't imagine. I can try and imagine, but I think, you know, there are some behaviours that to get to that level, to be consistent every day about those little things, getting enough sleep, all that kind of stuff, that you don't see as a reward in a day to day, but suddenly 3 months later, it's like, oh, you know, and that's, I would imagine that could be quite, trying to make that powerful at the time is probably really difficult. I don't know. That's the difference between people who stay in those programs for a long period, you know, obviously you in it for years, you know, that must have been really hard. Or was it? Or was it just like, no, these are positive choices that I'm making to stay in this environment? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a difficult one to answer. I mean, speaking from kind of personal level, I think, you know, I understood that if I did X, Y, and Z in a particular way, then that would probably be beneficial. I think, you know, sometimes when you get kind of young athletes who come in, or somebody who's been in an entirely different environment and they're perhaps, you know, really talented or capable or performing really well, and they kind of get brought in, that can be quite a steep learning curve. But yeah, it's definitely hard to see that. And I think going back to that kind of, I think there was a quote in the book around kind of like that deep learning is slow learning. And, you know, it's really difficult, isn't it, to bring that to life kind of, you know, in the short term. And I think that's, you know, if you've got, let's say you're coaching a club team and you coach them once a week, You know, that stuff can be really difficult, because if you're trying to start, maybe you're trying to bring in a new tactical thing, or you're kind of introducing something a little bit different, or you're trying to change the way that people think about something, you know, ultimately that probably doesn't just automatically sort of result in that happening on Saturday afternoon. It might take 6 weeks or 6 months, you know, for that to sort of actually start having a tangible, visible sort of outcome or result. I think the thing around the question around kind of balance and what a training session, you know, a coaching session might look like, I think probably variation is the key on that. So whether that looks like, you know, a conditioned game, let's say, a bit of a, you know, coachy sort of buzzwordy thing, but actually, you know, not just doing that, but just playing some hockey or some rugby or some football as well. And, you know, it always becomes pretty apparent to me when I'm kind of watching who the people are who can quickly translate the thing that we did 20 minutes ago in a sort of when there was a bonus point available to then, you know, recognizing when it might work in a normal game. And I, you know, obviously the other big challenge with that is you don't want people to stop playing a situation. So, you know, if you've said, right, you can score a goal in a particular way, you don't want that to turn into not scoring a goal in another way, because actually in that particular moment, that's the most effective way of doing it. So I think, you know, the difficult thing with this for our coaching, it obviously depends on what the context of your particular coaching is. Like, do you have the time to, you know, plan this session with all these variations, all this balance and all these different ideas? And if you don't, or you don't have the contact time with your group, sort of how do you prioritize it, and how do you sort of frame it to the players and potentially again the sort of the parents or the, you know, the club you work for, the school you work for, whatever it is. You know, and that's also a really big challenge, but again, I kind of think it's one of those ones which is definitely worth spending some time thinking about and figuring out how you can kind of make it happen in your environment, for sure.
I do feel that's probably where actually rewarding behaviour helps. So bridging that gap between the, say, isolation, it depends how you've introduced the skill or whatever, but by rewarding it in gameplay, I just wonder if that's the thing that creates that transition. Do you know what I mean? So you go into a if you've done a, I don't know, reverse hit or whatever on a training session, I'm down with the lingo. Like, you just say that and you just sound like you know what you're talking about in hockey. So that's, I knew I had to get that in somewhere. But then if you put that into a match and go, okay, great. Like, we're just going to have, let's just see how many we can do. Whatever, I often wonder if we need to reward more of that, that the score isn't the only thing we're counting effectively within a game. Do you know what I mean? It's actually what are our own skills, processes, behaviours, call them whatever you want. I think as coaches, maybe that's where we need to be looking at things and the group be looking at things to go winning. And we probably need to be really careful around our language. Well, winning is one thing, that might be a result, but can we be successful in doing other stuff? Like, if we're all about transition from training field to match, then we need to score some other stuff and we need to have some rewards or be explicit about it, I think.
I think it's also where the questioning comes in. And so it's, you know, you play one of those games, you keep score, but actually it's the asking people how it felt, you know, asking people sort of like, what impact did that have? You know, having a conversation with the player that you were directly up against, like all those kind of things. And again, it's super easy with this stuff. And we've got all these big kind of ideas as coaches to actually, you know, we all kind of know what we're supposed to be doing, but it's still really easy just to, like, you know, lead the discussion and talk about the kind of, you know, the behaviours we tried to encourage, and then did we do them? But actually, I think the kind of the underlying stuff around what it felt like, you know, did you feel under pressure, did you know when you were tired in the back end of it, did that change your thinking, did it change your execution, you know, talk to the person next to you, all that stuff. And it sounds like really obvious and we all know it, but actually, you know, doing it when you've got this big idea that you're trying to get across to people is definitely sometimes easier said than done.
The classic one is obviously taking all the conditions off and then watching it go back to the rubbish that it was beforehand and then saying, well, what changed, guys? You know, that the amount of times that's happened, you know, they put in a condition, they hate it, you know, this is really hard, but the hockey's really good. And then you say, okay, guys, I'll take the conditions off, you can do what you want. And then the hockey's rubbish and go, oh yeah, it was better before. Like, well, then why don't you do that all the time? You know, that's the thing where you just start banging your head against the wall, isn't it? But like, you know.
And then there's the thing of like time scales, you know, so if you've been doing something for 20 minutes, I kind of expect you, you know, you're going to see that sort of false performance, you know, that false signal and what is going to translate and actually what has been learned. And so it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. Sometimes I think with winning though, it's just so there, isn't it? We've just won the league. We've just won a game. I think it's a bit of a, it's just there. Whereas everything underneath that, that's just harder to sell sometimes.
The thing I would definitely add to that as well is it's like a real classic thing, right? To, you know, after you've lost a game, review everything, figure out kind of what went wrong. And it's definitely something that goes missing is the what went right when, you know, and it might even be what went right when we lost as well. But, you know, it's definitely just a huge thing. And I think that that's something which I think in a lot of top level sport is pretty good by and large. You know, it's if you succeed, whatever that looks like, you know, I think that does get reflected on, and probably you know, lower down in the game we don't always do that as well. And I think by extension, you know, kids or sort of players at a slightly lower level of the game don't necessarily do it as well.
As you say, yeah, really easy just to let that result. You can win and be really bad. Like, let's not pretend that that's not a thing, is it? And winning teams, and this makes me laugh that it kind of changed slightly, but you people will crave an understanding of the culture in a winning team. And it's like, it doesn't always have to be good. Like, there's plenty of teams that have won stuff that were toxic, but they found a way to make that work for them. And I do think maybe we just get caught up in that. Yeah, let's hunt for the people that look like they're successful. And actually, it's just an outside judgment, isn't it? Unless you're in the heart of that, do we really know what makes people tick and how they've constructed that environment? And I think it was a French rugby team a few years ago, one of the World Cups, the coach was on his way out and there was story after story of, oh, he's lost the changing room. And I'm kind of like, well, maybe that's a plan. Like, maybe he was, if they really dislike me, it will bring them together right at the moment. But do you know what I mean? Like, and I go back, like, one of my absolute favorite movies is Miracle, about the ice hockey Olympic team. And he's like, there's that quote in there where he's really brutal on them in terms of fitness and stuff. And he's like, well, the doc goes, oh, maybe if they hate him, they'll stop hating each other. And it's just like, oh, yeah, that's genius. Like, if you know the group, you do you know what I mean? You can be really quite manipulative. And I don't mean that in a nasty way, but if your job is to get the best out of people to get a result, maybe you're going to do whatever you need to get that. And it's just, as I say, it's not something everybody, I think, should just start doing, is getting their team to hate them by any stretch. But
I tried that tactic, Phil.
Yeah.
Genuinely.
It was intentional.
Yeah, no, that's the same.
I honestly thought I was the smartest guy in the room. Like, really, we played really badly. We only lost 1-0. And actually, when I analysed it later, we played pretty well. We pretty much executed the game plan. Our captain got, like, a concussed in the first minute. So, like, that pretty much sort of... So, we lost 1-0. And at the end of it, but we did actually lost a couple of games on the trot. So, I'd always sort of pre-planned, if we lose today, I'm going to be the bad guy. They're going to unite around, like, their hatred of me sort of thing. And, one of the guys who was in the team, who's also like a really clever guy, really good friend of mine, like a lecturer, also a coach with him at Performance Centre. We were driving back from the game, bear in mind, so I'd like laid into them for 5 minutes, basically said, you guys have got to sort it out. And I sort of fake stormed off to the sat in my car, sort of thing, you know. And then like they went for tea and everything. And then we were driving back and he just goes, that was a bold move. You know, I was just like, all right. I was just like, well, what do you think? Do you think it's going to have the desired effect? He goes, no, I don't think so. They didn't think you were being genuine.
Too nice, mate. Too nice. You're clearly...
Well, and the guy who was concussed just said, he just thinks he's too smart. You know, it's just like, none of them believed it. Apparently they just sat around going, yeah, well, you know, bless him, he's trying sort of thing, you know.
I think that, like, not to be sort of boring and serious around it, I do think, like, I read a quote a few weeks ago, and it was like, it was along the lines of, you know, what do you want on your gravestone? Do you want, you know, like, world champion, or do you want good person? And like, and I think that's sort of the, you know, it like 100%, you're not going to be successful all the time by being nice, but that, you know, I think fundamentally sort of actually having a reflection on, you know, whether you're a coach, you're a player, you're whatever you are kind of thing in, well, in our world, obviously sport kind of, yeah, what do you kind of, what do you actually want your sort of legacy to be? What do you want the story to be that you tell your grandkid or whatever? And, you know, for some people, maybe that is just, oh yeah, I won a gold medal. But I would think the most powerful stories probably are the ones which, you know, have something behind that gold medal. And then kind of the extension to that is everybody else who didn't win a gold medal, you know, you can still have an incredible sort of story behind it. And yeah, that's definitely something I think I'm really trying to strive towards in my coaching, and sort of try and help players see the world kind of, or, you know, at least consider seeing the world from that viewpoint, even if they don't quite get there.
No, I love that. And I think maybe that's the sea change we've seen, I guess, the British cycling, gymnastics type things. You haven't got to be abusive. You haven't got to be a bully. You haven't got to do, you can win and not do that stuff. Like, I think they're the real key stories, aren't they? There's not only one way to do it. And yeah, as someone that's not been in those environments, that must be, it's really easy to judge. But I would say I still come across probably lots of people nowhere near that environment that still think that's the way to operate. And I just, yeah, I think that's the biggest change we'd maybe want to see. And hopefully that comes from the top down, but we'll see. Fantastic. We'll stop that one there. So Helen, we're coming across to you. What are you going to chat to us about?
It's a book that was just next on my pile when this opportunity came around, and it's called Move! By Caroline Williams, who's a science writer, and the subtitle is The New Science of Body Over Mind. And it's very much within this sort of popular science writing about why we move, why is exercise good for us. And it's not you know, there's no major revelations. It's, you know, sports pretty good for you, but it's interesting. There's you know, that it's following on the last like 10 years of research or so, and these things move on. So there were, you know, there were little nuggets in there that I quite enjoyed. But I'm interested, I mean, it, reading it reminded me of all the things I've read. So I read a book a couple of years ago, and it's Anna Cassell, who I think writes for the Daily Telegraph, I think. And it was about like girls playing sport and why don't they play sport. And this book, Move, just talks about how we are built to move. The human body is built to move. We have evolved to move. I think that there's the quote, a scientist, and it's like we're cognitively engaged endurance athletes. That's what humans are, you know, on 2 feet. That is what we're designed to do. But there's an evolutionary gap now, because the evolutionary pressures are that we move to think, we think to move. This aligns to some of my coaching biases anyway. But this gap means that if that is what is healthy for us and that is what we're supposed to be doing, we're not now, you know, the last 50 years, last 100 years, we are living these increasingly sedentary lifestyles. And, you know, as it relates to children and girls and whatever, you're looking at it and going, we just, you know, they're missing something. They're missing the absolute, the joy of movement. I mean, you were speaking to my biases, but as a kid, you know, like we ran around a lot. I mean, I've got like a twin brother and grew up with like a load of like neighbours, and we'd go out and play tag, and that's what we did. And just actually the joy of running until you're out of breath, movement for movement's sake and sports for sport's sake. And sometimes I worry, and even the environments that I'm in, sometimes it's so adult informed. It's so you come and do this, and this is my sports bit, and we're missing this diet. But there's all these sort of these, you know, these barriers to it. So I think there was some report or another, and it was like under 11s in this country, 3/4 of them do less than like an hour of sport a day. These all these horrendous statistics. And if we're built to move, this is going to have an impact on our mental health. So the research is all around. I mean, it's sort of across lots of disciplines. So the neuroscience, the cell biology, the exercise physiology, the evolutionary biology. And if you've read some of the recent things like the culture code and the talent code, you know, this idea of myelin around the brain, or like sapiens, this idea of how we've evolved, it's all very much within that milieu. But I was interested, you know, like the gamification stuff, the Magic Academy. And I've heard Stuart Armstrong talk about this, that really video game design is very clever. I mean, there's market forces why video design is clever. If the design is not clever, people don't play the game. But children can sit there. It's a very safe environment. It's psychologically safe. No one's going to judge you. If you can't run very fast, there is no judgment there. And it's perfectly designed at your level. It gets to these desirable difficulties. It's this level, and then you can train a little bit over here in beginner mode. Or I don't know much about video games, but this idea of gamification that was kind of bringing over. And I suppose that my thing is, sport is there for us. Sport is this golden ticket. Sport is all those cognitive little hooks that video games is giving us, and why video games are so popular. But you are connecting with people. You are outside. You are moving around, you are doing what the human body is meant to do. And I just find myself sort of really, really interested in that now. What are the barriers and how can I break it down? And I almost sometimes think, like, hockey just happens to be the medium through which I'm doing it sometimes. And I just think, I don't know whether I'm just sort of getting like old and crusty, but I just do think that it is important. I mean, there was some really interesting, as a hockey player, they've looked at apparently like the shoulder throw. We've evolved like a throw, like the best like animal in the world. And it's just really good for the brain. Just go throw something as hard as you can. And I think any hockey player would relate to, do you know what, I just want to go down to the pitch and just whack a ball at the goal as hard as I can. And all these things. And there is a psychological benefit to it. There is a cognitive benefit. There is a mental benefit. And we've just got to be better at sort of, like, being ambassadors for, or not just hockey, just for everything, getting children moving outside, basically. There's some research, I think the guy's called Andrew Huberman, and he talks about optic flow. So not flow, like the like flow states, but optic flow. So when you are literally in an environment, walking, and it particularly works better, it doesn't matter if it's outside, great, but greenery helps. It's just a reset for the brain. It's a reset for the nervous system. Just to go, so I know you could be riding a bike or you could be driving, but the brain sort of knows that you're moving through space. And then there's all this thing, you know, our natural gait as humans is just perfect for sort of thinking. It's in like, you know, 120 BPM time, or so many hertz, or relates to so many breaths. And why like yoga is really good for you, because like a yoga breath relates to certain brain waves. So it's like, it delves into all this research. You know, the too long didn't read is that like moving is really good. One of the girls I play hockey with is a physio, and she's like, motion is illusion. So I was like, I'll say that tomorrow. Please. I'll make sure I say that. So that's it. Move by Caroline Williams.
I love that. Thank you very much. I often wonder, as the freedom has been constricted on kids outside, is that why they've gone and looked for freedom in a video game? Because as you say, like when you go over the park or you go over the woods and you build dens and you do all that type of stuff, and as people have got more and more conscious of that, you're not allowed to do that. Actually, well, I can do that on a video game. Like this video game through a screen, I can pretty much do anything I want. And has that replaced the freedom we had?
I mean, I think we're going to see, like, you know, virtual reality, you will be Serena Williams. Like you will be that, you know, you'll be that player and you'll get that experience and it'll probably be really close to it, but we're kind of just to miss the actual bit of it. I think does worry me. I think
it could be the other way around as well, though, that the less you go outdoors, the more dangerous it appears. So if you're in that environment all the time, it's a safe environment, you know. When you're not in that environment, suddenly people worry. Oh, that, you know, and I think that's almost like the kind of the payoff, isn't it? That because people, even gradually, and obviously it might be more accelerated, if you're not comfortable in that environment, it is perceived to be unsafe. You know, I would, and again, you know, I know this is all rose tinted glasses, but I remember going for miles as a, you know, primary school with my mates. My parents had no idea where I was. They just trusted that we'd be back, you know, and they trusted us, you know, and they trusted us because they sort of been with us in that environment, but then it also sort of let us out a little bit further and a little bit further. And there isn't that trust anymore. No, the world's dangerous. Stay in. Oh, video games, something to do whilst I'm not allowed out.
I think I'd also add in like the sort of role that educational sort of institutions have and education more widely, because, you know, like there's so much emphasis now on, you know, exams, academic kind of progress, league tables, all, you know, all the stuff that we all know about, that it takes away doing things for doing things sake. And I think there's so much kind of mileage in that in terms of stuff like sport and being outside and, you know, working in teams, all those kind of things, because unfortunately just the time and the emphasis is so heavily weighted towards things that we can measure and, you know, ways that we can measure an individual, and then ways we can measure a year group and a school and an area and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it was one of the things which sort of really I saw as such an opportunity during the kind of with the pandemic. You know, you just looked at it and you thought, God, what an amazing opportunity just to sort of shift the balance within education. And it seemed to actually sort of make it worse, if anything. So I guess it's, yeah, it's, do we need to just accept that that's the way it is, or, you know, can we push it kind of from the other end as well, an environment that every kid is in or should be in, you know, and what that looks like and what priorities it's given.
Do you think we're our own worst enemies as coaches in that sense, to like, we need to get out of the way, because we do that classic, right, I need to be there half an hour early and I need to greet every kid and I need to have everything else laid out ready, rather than just maybe we turn up at 5 minutes before the session and all the stuff was there, but we were off doing some other stuff and we just let them do free play. Like, how much free play time do we build into our sessions?
Well, I think you're right, but that is not a fault of the coaching context. Let's just say that's always been there. That's a fault of the diet around it. And that is the, you know, they're only getting this diet like there, and not all the other bits around it. And so now we go like, oh, I've got a little building a bit of free play, or like, or me and my ball time or whatever into the session, that it almost we're trying to compensate for the stuff that's not happening anyway. And then we moan like, oh, kids can't do a warm up, or oh, they've got no ideas, and they don't have space to do it. I mean, and they don't have the, you know, they're not having the opportunity to do it. And like Bex said, it's such a missed opportunity. Like, we know, like the science is telling us, we know that just walking around for like a couple of minutes is going to help you. It's going to help you focus better. It's going to help you remember better. It's going to help it. Like, there's all stuff to do with the hippocampus, you know, it's damping down the response just as you're walking and kind of allowing like blue sky thinking. And that's just a function of, that's happening physiologically in the body. And yet it's like we're going to sit in the classroom and sort of essentially drill children to live an inch of their lives.
I always remember being a kid in school, and any time it was a hot day, it was like, could we do the lesson outside? Because you just want to enjoy it, don't you? It doesn't, a change of environment in that sense, just sat on a grass listening to someone talk would have been a complete change to just sat behind a desk with an enforced barrier in front of you and your mates and stuff. And I just wonder, yeah, maybe we just need to change the dynamic of, even if it's, we're still delivering in some way, but actually can we change the environment or just do other stuff differently?
Well, from a really like geeky point of view, we changed sports day this year in school because of the pandemic. And from a self-determination theory, it filled all the boxes. I was watching it and rather than like kind of the children put their hands up if they want to do the sprints, and then certain kids never self-select, and then some of the kids are like, well, people are going to be laughing at me. And all it was there were eight of them still running. That's how many could go in each round. But the teams were split into two teams, so red, yellow, blue, green. So you had quite a good chance of coming first, second or third, because there's only four of you racing, either you or your teammate, and everyone had to do everything. So it was in these sort of separate bubbles. But then so you might come last if you are not a fantastic sprinter, but you came first in the throw. And how do you know you are not a discus thrower if you've never thrown a discus? And I just, you know, they did all the events, all of them, and the success rate was really high, probably artificially high, probably a little badge just for taking part. But there was success there. And you could just see some of these children who've never done sport, they were kind of forced to do it, going like, well, I came first. I mean, I was like, we need to do this again because because it was they had success, they were having a sense of mastery, however much it might be a bit of a psychological trick at the time. They were connecting with their teammates. The teammates were cheering for them and their mates. So it wasn't often that two of them were seventh and eighth. One would have been second. They were cheering that person. So it was sort of like sort of arrived at by accident, but in the event was just, you just like, there's a way to do this, I think. There's a way for all children to access it and enjoy it. And we just gotta, but is it, you know, it's not, I just don't think it's just for coaches. I think it's for all of us, society at large.
This might take us on a slight tangent, but do you think losing in sport actually has the real positive effect that lots of advocates would have for it with kids, that life is hard, so we should make sport hard and we should make sure we have losers because that will help you in your life? Because I'm not convinced at all. Like, I don't see the logic how it translates, to be completely honest, but I'd be really interested in your thoughts. Like, should we force kids to lose?
I mean, hate to be that it depends person, but like, it depends, doesn't it? I mean, context is everything. And I don't know, it depends what you want to get. It depends what your intention is, I think, for a particular group of children who are in front of you. I think it's a little bit like it's mollycoddling the right word, you know, to not, you are gonna lose, but there's a way to do it and there's a way to experience it, and it's not the end of the world. And we talk about these things like resilience and grit, you know, and actually doing it and what that actually looks like is a difficult thing. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's overblown, this idea of like, oh, you know, toughen them up. But I mean, I suppose it goes back to that if there's a good diet of it, if they're losing a game in the playground, it doesn't matter. If they're playing for Manchester United Academy at the weekend, then that's different. But it seems to be such a narrowing band of their experiences, or just play, not even sport, like play experiences.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think the play bit is probably the key, because it's basically about having fun. And, you know, ultimately, yes, you might, there might be other things which you enjoy, but if all you're striving for is that little 30 seconds, you know, glory at the end of the race, or, you know, getting handed out a little shiny plastic medal or whatever it is, then probably somewhere along the line, the point's been missed in the activity itself.
I mean, I think as well, yeah, and then this is, this is a counterpoint. You know, I think we're pretty deluded as coaches in terms of the amount of time that we spend with them. Like, yeah, you know, kids, we lose all the time, day in, day out. You know, I lose every time I walk to my front door because my little boy runs past me and says, I win. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many times, you know, it's not just in a sporting context, do you win or lose? There's times where you're successful and times where you're not successful. They will be getting feedback in class from their peers, from their teachers, and it's continual. So, you know, and again, that kind of success around goes back to your point, Becky, doesn't it? You know, that there's the result at the end, but you can win and you can walk off the pitch feeling pretty much like you've lost, because every time you had the ball, you got tackled or whatever it might be, you know. And there's a lot of implicit feedback around winning and losing that maybe we don't notice as coaches 24 hours a day, you know. So do kids need to lose? No, I'd probably say no. But do you want learning experiences that are really tough? So I read a quote. Oh, did I tell you guys this? It was brilliant. It's in a book. It's an audio book, and it was like a strong nautical theme of an analogy, and it was, you know, ships are safe in the harbour, but ships are built for the seas. And this idea that, you know, you can be safe, you can be kind of mollycoddled, or, you know, you can go out and test yourself against the best in the storm, and that might not turn out that well, but you're going to learn a lot. And I think that's really powerful. It's something I've talked about, you know. I want my players to go and test themselves against the best, and it means we might lose, but we're going to learn from it and we're going to be better sailors at the end of the day, kind of thing, you know. Again, that's how you frame it, isn't it? It's what you guys said. It depends. Do you frame it right? Do you support them knowing that it's going to be a tough day at the office, or do you still say you should have won? You know, do you know what I mean? What is the learning outcome you want to get from it? Do you want them to feel terrible, or do you want them to feel like, I tell you what, if I train really well, we might be able to play like them one day? Does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Even just in the language there, I wonder if we often conflate the life argument around this with winning and losing rather than successful and unsuccessful. Because I would separate them. Do you know what I mean? Just because I lose, I can still be successful. So I'm not sure. People, you know, they always use job interviews. Oh, you're going to go through loads of job interviews. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I didn't lose to the other people by not getting a job. Like I wasn't even in the same room as them at any one point. So how was that a direct head-to-head? Like, I can be unsuccessful in not getting a job, but I'm not sure I lost it. And I don't necessarily think I won the job. Like, I was successful in gaining the job. So I don't know. I quite like getting into the nuance of the argument, because it just seems to fall apart a little bit, that these people that say, no, life is hard, kids need to understand that. Or you can go, yeah, maybe kids need to understand being unsuccessful. Maybe they can't get the sweets the moment they want them. You know, that you could almost say that they're unsuccessful in that. But I'm not sure they lost. Like, I don't think losing actually means that much when it comes to the bigger, wider world. But
it's also the danger of comparison, isn't it? So, like, if you think about it in terms of, like, grades at school, and, you know, you get an A, B, C, D, whatever, and, like, the only time that starts to become actually sort of problematic in people's heads is because they compare their B to somebody else's A or to somebody else's C. Whereas actually, you know, if grades were genuinely a sort of snapshot of your sort of capability in that particular subject at that particular time, it would be perceived in a completely different way. And I think it's probably a similar sort of thing with the sports day idea. You know, because you came third in the egg and spoon race, like, you know, does that matter? Did you get a better time than last time you did the egg and spoon race? Have you thought about something which might improve your capabilities in the egg and spoon race, not just like, you know, oh, two people beat me and I beat two people? It's kind of, yeah, how you frame that comparison.
Have you seen the Frank Dick, he's an athletics coach, it's the real, like, kind of viral video that goes around about the sprinter. Little kid comes up to him and says, oh, you know, please can you coach me to sprint? And he's like, okay, fine, and runs, I don't know, like a 17 second 100 meters. So, like, oh, I didn't do very well. Well, hold on, that's a PB, first time you've ever run it, but that's a PB, that's your own world record, blah blah blah, right? Next time you run it, actually you run 15 seconds. Well, that's success. Okay, but it doesn't matter where you come, whether you come first in your race or you come eighth. But if you run an 18-second 100, then you've not done, that's, you know, you've not been successful, and that's how you learn. And he just, I'll link for anyone that hasn't seen it that's listening, I'll link it into the blurb, because it really is, it's about 3 or 4 minutes, but I just think it's really powerful about how you set targets and expectations for people to measure themselves as class.
Yeah, Phil, I was going to say there's another one, which is like, you know, do you fall forwards or do you fall backwards? You know, if you're climbing your mountain, if you fall forwards, you get up, you keep going up the mountain. If you fall backwards, you've rolled down the hill, you've got to start again, you know. And it's that idea that if you've got a positive mindset, if you're willing to learn from your mistakes, you keep sort of scrambling and crawling your way up the mountain. You know, if you don't, it's a bloody big hill, you know.
Like the winder.
That's a great hill.
My Achilles disagrees.
By the way, Nick, I didn't say it earlier, but you were talking about getting into the cold water swimming club. You're signed up for river swims next summer, mate. You're in the club now. Yes,
mate. You know what? I'm signed up to a lot of things. Whether or not I can actually get off the hockey pitch to go to them is the other thing. I did take my kids in the river on Wednesday night, and it was just, it is amazing. I do like it, you know. Yeah, it's good fun.
Did you sign that off with Dusk beforehand, and have you got that risk assessed? That might be an issue. That's fine.
He's not talking to me about it.
Oh, okay. Fair. Well, that's probably a whole other discussion. Right, I'm conscious of your time, because it's 25 to 10 on a Sunday night. So I think we will hold that one there. This has been absolutely brilliant. I've loved it. Just before I round up, have you guys got any other recommendations, putting you on the spot now, for good content Helen, I'm looking at that extensive bookcase behind you, thinking maybe you've got some other books you can recommend. But yeah, if you guys have got anything you would want to give a shout out to, then now is the time. So please, you don't have to, but please dive on in if you do.
I tell you what, it just reminded me when you're talking about language, it was Pippa Grainger's book about, she was like the physio, not physio, sorry, the sports psychologist for England at the World Cup in 2018, did this up on the penalties, and just talk about language, how it's always like really attritional and like it going to war and we battle, and maybe it doesn't have to be that way. That was quite good. I think I enjoyed that.
Great. I will Google that one and I'll add that into the blurb.
I mean, I've got a couple living up here in kind of Runningville in Sebba. I read two books recently, Running with the Kenyans and Out of Thin Air, which is about Ethiopian running. And actually, you know, it's big time on all these things we talked about in terms of just diving into a different culture completely, you know, a kind of just how they do things, how they feel, you know. I mean, we're talking motivation to change your life. It's pretty big, but then how they go about that, I found them to be really, again, really powerful books. You know, really, you know, you can apply it to pretty much anything. If you want to build these things around culture and relationships and that kind of thing, really understand the people that you're coaching, you know, and where they're coming from.
Love it. Thank you very much. Great stuff. Guys, as I say, it's been an absolute blast. Thank you very, very much for coming on. It's been a great discussion. So I'll round up the roundup. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks again to the guests for coming on and contributing to a really insightful discussion. Links to all the content discussed are available in the blurb on Rugby Coach Weekly. As always, I'd like to thank you for listening. Wish you all the best and go well.